This is The Big Web Show, episode number 48. The Big Web Show features special guests, but not today, and topics like web publishing, art direction, content strategy, typography, web technology, and more. It's everything web that matters. The show is hosted by Jeffrey Zeldman. He is a creator of the internet, the godfather of the web, and by me. I'm Dan Benjamin. And this episode is sponsored by Web Trends Analytics 10. This is an all-in-one analytics package for mobile apps, social media, and websites. They just launched a brand new version. They gave me a sneak peek at it last week. It is totally awesome when it comes to understanding website traffic, marketing channels, campaigns, the online social space. You don't need more data. You need the right data in context, on demand. And this is exactly what Analytics 10 gives you. It's amazing. It integrates with Facebook, Twitter, your RSS feeds, you name it. And you've got to go check it out. Go to webtrends.com/bigwebshow. And you can go check that out. It's very awesome. We'd also like to thank MailChimp.com, as always, for doing what they do, being awesome. You can send 12,000 emails a month to a list of up to 2,000 subscribers. This is all free. They've got amazing integrations like social sharing integrations with Facebook. They've got A/B split testing for you geeks out there, Google Analytics integration, autoresponders, you name it. It's all free. There really has not been a better time to join MailChimp. Check them out at MailChimp.com. And when you do that, you will be supporting this show. Jeffrey, you are literally just off the train from Boston, where you just completed an event apart, Boston, for 2011.
And boy, are my arms tired. Yep, I just got off the Acela Express from Boston.
How long does that take?
Like 3 hours. It's an incredibly civilized way to travel. I got my MiFi in my pocket. Basically, I decided I was going to stay with AT&T rather than join everyone in switching to Verizon.
Oh, right.
But I bought a Verizon MiFi to hedge my bets. I had a Verizon contract for something else, a dongle or something that was useless. It was like something from the prehistoric past. It was actually just like 2 years old, but completely obsolete. So I said, I switched to a MiFi. So I've got like an AT&T connection with a Verizon connection in my pocket. Then the train itself occasionally has internet connectivity. They advertise that they have Wi-Fi, and they kind of do. But between those three things, I was able to stay connected, and it was really nice. You're sitting there working, having a nice meal, looking out the window as Connecticut passes by. Mm. It's beautiful, beautiful. It's like sitting in your office, only you're speeding along, and someone's coming up and asking, "Shine your shoes, Gov." It's very nice. It's like the 1940s, really.
So that's always how I imagine traveling by train would be.
You won't have a chance to find out. You're moving to Austin.
Yeah, I don't know if they have any trains there.
They do. They have a little toy train that goes like
from like the one I put my son on when I take him to the zoo?
A little bigger than that. I think that's their public. You know, most of the country, most of the United States, we didn't invest in infrastructure because Detroit told us not to. Because we were always going to have cars, and our cars were the joy of the world, right. So and the envy of the world.
Independence and freedom.
Yeah.
And you are both an adult and somebody who does not have a driver's license.
I no longer have a driver's license. That's correct.
You could drive at one time legally.
Yeah, and I just have to take care of that. But
just the idea for somebody like me who lives in right now a totally suburban area, but soon to be a somewhat more metropolitan suburban area, the idea of not having a car and license is. It sounds great. I mean, it sounds really awesome not needing one, but it just, I can't imagine it.
Well, okay, so I live in New York, right? So I walk everywhere. I can take the subway everywhere. I can take the bus everywhere. There's trains. You know, there's a lot of disadvantages to being in New York, but one advantage is there's this incredible condensation. What would be like 15 cities worth of stuff with, you know, Australia in between each city
right.
is all compressed into this one very vertical place, and you walk 10 blocks and you're in a completely different neighborhood.
Right.
So that's really cool. That all works for me. And my driver's license elapsed when I moved here. I used to basically get my Pennsylvania driver's license renewed in Pittsburgh, and they sent it to my dad. And my dad said, oh, Jeff won't need this anymore, and threw it in the trash. I don't know why. I don't know why. And this was many years ago. He was a young man when he did this. It wasn't like a senior mistake. It was just, he did the same thing to my brother, too. My brother's a drummer. He drives to gigs, right? My brother was the guy who had to have the car and, you know, all that. And the driver's license renewal came, and my dad said, Pete won't need this. Threw it in the trash. So, and at the time, I was living kind of a shady life in New York, so I didn't actually notice that I didn't have a driver's license. And then when I noticed, I was like kind of relieved, like, well, I won't kill anybody. And then, kill anyone with a car.
Right.
And by driving while under the influence. And now it's, you know, that hasn't been a problem for a long time. But, every time I go to the DMV, I mean, I can be there for hours and I'm never, you know, you finally get it's all the reasons that you will never live in New York boiled into, I finally get to the front of the line after waiting and waiting. And the guy says, it's wrong form. And that's it.
And that you think they take some kind of pleasure in that.
The last guy who did this to me, he was 42 years old. He lived with his mother. He obviously took pleasure in this. He just looked at me and said, you're a loser too, but you're a more successful. I don't know. I was just in Boston. My New York accent's coming out Boston, if anything. So anyway, so we were talking about the web.
Yeah. So what's this like? You go out there. You show up, you're at some kind of big hotel, some fancy thing. You get up on stage, talk a little bit, laugh a little bit, and then
work? Okay, so Eric Meyer and I organized this conference, right? And we had just amazing. We had Jeremy Keith. We had Ethan Marcotte, Whitney Hess, Viola Peters, Luke Rablewski, Aaron Walter. We just had amazing people, Andy Clark. I'm just doing that for memory. So it's
an all-star cast.
Mark Bolton, Jeffrey Veen, the CEO of Typekit.
And he keeps getting taller every time I see him.
He's scary. He actually has a dark side. Not many people know this. So Jeff Veen is about 7 feet tall. He's perhaps the greatest speaker in our industry. He could talk about nothing and you'd be enthralled, but he actually always has something profound and momentous to say. He's a really wonderful guy and a really wonderful speaker, and he always comes across as kind of a genial, laid back, you know, friendly fellow. I mean, part of his success is because, I mean, there are people in this industry who, when they succeed, you're like, damn, I hate that guy.
Right.
You know, that guy just sold us. But when Jeff Veen sold something to Google, people were like, yeah, all right, I hope he made money. I hope he did. And then when he left Google, they're like, yeah, I want, no matter what Jeff Veen does, people really want him to do well because he's a great guy. But right. He truly has a dark side. We had this speaker dinner, and he's like 7 feet tall, and I'm like 3 feet tall. And he gets up from the table because he's got to go to the Typekit party. Typekit's sponsoring a party for an event apart, and he wants, you know, he has to go there. And I look up at him, and I say, good night, Shorty. And he looks down at me and says, do you really want to start that? And his eyes turn like orange, you know, and everyone else in the room sort of fades away. It's like this black chill descends. There's just me and him in the world. And he's like looking down at me with these glowing eyes. And I was just like, no, sir, I don't. And then the moment passed and he was like back to himself. But, you know, everybody has a dark side, even Jeff Veen.
What do you think was it? What was the trigger point for him? I mean, what was the...
He was just a joke.
That was it.
He was just being funny. He was just being funny, but
it was effective.
Did you see Night on Bald Mountain in Fantasia? You're a Disney fan, I assume.
I've seen the Fantasia when I was a kid, though.
Right. Well, you remember it's the thing where
the devil part?
The devil, right. Yeah. The devil rises out of a mountain.
Yeah.
That's what happened.
Terrified me as a little kid.
Yeah. It was awesome. Terrified me, but I wanted to see it again.
Yeah. The hippos are not as scary.
I've seen that movie under many conditions and situations in my life. I have to see it again.
So I've heard things about you.
Yeah, we have no topic. See, this is why we need guests. This is
I've heard things about you, about this, the way you run this conference.
About the conference?
About the way you run it.
So people were saying Jeremy Keith's talk, for instance, was about digital preservation, which is a topic my ex-wife, who's a librarian, used to talk about. It's a really important topic. We think all the stuff we're doing is permanent, but we're actually working in the most impermanent medium ever. We'd really be better off working in vellum than making digital stuff, right? It's true. Calfskin. I mean, if you think about things, and so he gives this amazing talk, erudite but completely accessible, completely approachable, full of, you know, timeless references, pop culture references, just amazing stuff. And everyone's kind of drooling with their jaws slack. And usually at a web design conference, if someone started, you know, talking about the pyramids and the invention of the printing press and all that, people would say, "Well, I don't get. When is he going to get to the?" I'm going to do the Boston thing again. When's he going to tell me how to make rounded corners? I came here to learn to make rounded corners. But, you know, but the Inventor part's not like that. People just loved it. And they were all tweeting and saying, wow, this should be a TED talk. See, but I think TED should be a small subset of an Inventor part myself.
Right. Well, that would make sense to me.
That makes sense to me. But I have a sort of a web designer's perspective on everything. So.
But so here's what I'm saying. I've heard things about the way behind the scenes,
the cookies,
how you run this thing. And I'd like to share this. I don't know if this is true. This is just something I've heard.
Ask me these things because I have no idea what you're talking
They're
about.
They're not bad.
Okay.
I've heard that you, and this may be a thing of the past, that you require or did require that the, I don't want to say proposal, but that the perhaps the outline or the in-depth description along with the slides and everything that these are speakers who typically have a lot of speaking experience, that they get you the whole thing well in advance.
That's true.
And not just like a week in it. And this when I heard this, that made me feel so good about this event. It's more than just a conference. I mean, it's an event, because so often I've gone to speak and they want a topic, one sentence topic, a title, and, you know, maybe if like they're really in depth, they get a paragraph from you. So that and then when I finally get there, I realize, you know, I can talk about whatever I really feel like. I'm, you know, if I make the topic broad enough. And typically your talks, you know, they go pretty well, but there are a lot of people who, and this was like the joke, at least at a lot of the conferences, the geek conferences I've been to, is that everybody does their talk like on the plane on the way over in the hotel room the night before or something. And like, oh, I didn't see Jim all day yesterday. He must be talking today because he's in his hotel room writing it the day before, you know.
Oh, and people do edit. In fact, we've had people editing in the green room while listening to other people's talks. Last year, that was a big thing in Seattle.
Really?
Okay. So what we should be is ashamed with our show that we don't line up our speakers well in advance and discuss topics. But it's a more informal show, right? Our podcast, the Big Web Show.
Yeah.
And I apologize to both listeners. But but with an event apart, I mean, we're taking a huge financial risk. We're booking these things that cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to rent, right? And with minimums, like you say, $80,000 catering minimums and all this, and you're just signing this stuff up. And if we have a bad product, like I'm going to lose my home,
right?
If we have a bad product, forget about the ethics of it. Pretend we don't care about that. But and here's the real thing. The reason we're doing this, and there are many good conferences, don't get me wrong, but look, I started a list apart because I didn't like the web magazines that existed. There were web magazines online web magazines talking about web design that didn't seem to talk about the stuff I wanted to read about. So I started a list apart. And Eric and I started this conference because we were often in the position of advising other people, who should they have speak and all this. And we thought we could do a better job. And there are people who might hear this and think I'm talking about them, and I'm definitely not talking about you guys. You guys are cool. But I've been to conferences where it was clear that there was no sense of who the audience was. Nothing was communicated to these speakers, so they didn't have a chance to craft the right presentation. And they would get up there and You know, one person will give a really advanced JavaScript talk to a room full of beginners, right? Or, we've all been in shows where it was obvious there was nobody thinking about the content in advance. So Eric and I work really hard with, we keep finding the best speakers that we can. We find people who, under ordinary circumstances, would just phone it in. I mean, could phone it in, and it would still be fantastic. People who could phone it in. They don't, but they could, and they'd be fantastic. People like, you know, Christina Halverson, Jeffrey Veen, Jared Spool, you know, just amazing people. And we work with them to make sure that there's a flow to the content, that there's either tension between the different topics, right? So, you know, last year, Dan Cederholm was talking about progressive enrichment while Andy Clark was saying bullshit. There's no such thing as progressive enhancement. That's been tying our hands. Let's not do that. Let's do the other thing. Let's do what Flash designers did. Let's do what we used to do in the old days. Let's make stuff that is designed to be the best experience possible for the people who can best experience it, and then work backwards. So he was sort of, and so there was this tension between these two very good designers, very well-known CSS advocates. They were taking this, these contrary approaches, and it made for an interesting afternoon. It was just part of the afternoon, and things like that. It's really important to nail down what the event's going to. I mean, it's really a show. I read a lot about Hitchcock. You know, I love Alfred Hitchcock, and he used to say he was bored when he actually made his movies because he'd done so much pre-production. Sketching the shot.
Oh, so this is just more like just reenacting what he's already played 100 times in his mind.
In his mind, right. He knew, he knows that the blood's going to go down the shower and this, in this pattern, and it's all, everything's storyboarded out. So he claimed, I'm sure that, actually having Janet Leigh or Cary Grant act your stuff out and, actually filming it is a totally different experience, but he claimed that it was a little boring, and I'm certainly not bored at our show, but I know what's going to happen, and I have a pretty good sense of how things are going to go, and it makes it a really good experience, I think, for people.
It sounds to me like you're a big believer in preparation.
It depends. Yeah. In things that are done for people. Right. In client services work, we do like tons of prep, and but not on this show, not on the Big Web Show. The Big Web Show is just if you don't edit the beginning of this, assuming we even release this, we may just,
No, this is coming out.
It is. If this comes out, I mean, the first 10 minutes was, I don't know, about nonsense about my driver's license. So it wasn't like it was pretty clear we didn't plan.
I'll tell you something is that, and this is absolutely not a knock in any way against our guests, but some of the more popular shows that we've done, some of the more popular big web shows that we've done have been the shows where it was just you and me. Now, I'm not, again, I mean, clearly there have been other ones that have been far more popular than that, but they rank in the higher levels of popularity. Why do you think that is?
That's a mystery. I don't know. Well, I think you and I like each other, and we have a nice conversational flow. So, but I don't know why listening to two friends talk about the web would be that interesting.
I could talk exclusively about you and the influence you've had on me and my career for the next 20 minutes and not repeat myself once. I think that's a part of it. I think the audience is listening, and this is what you don't realize, because you're just like to yourself, you're just that guy you see in the mirror. But to most people who go to these events, they're going to them because of people like you and Jeff Veen and Whitney and all the other amazing people who speak to them. In the world that designers, especially designers, live in, you guys are the people who have really, really laid the groundwork, if that's the right expression, or paved the road, so to speak, for everybody else to drive on. And take me back to that whole web standards time when you used to sit there and write about the web standards all the time.
Okay, so I mean, I know what you're talking about.
You know what I mean?
You're talking about if you're a teacher or if you're a writer and you've touched somebody, right? They let you know, and that's a really wonderful thing. I mean, I've had I know what you're talking. People come up to me and say, please sign this book. I mean, not walking down the street. This happens at conferences. It happens, you know, at an event apart or South by Southwest or something like that. It's not going to, you know, it's not going to happen at Benny's Chinese restaurant. But although that would be kind of cool if it did. Your book taught me also.
Right.
Also, soup or salad. That was I can't.
It's good.
I can do accents, but it's so racist when I do it that I can't. That's what it is. I'm inhibited against doing the horrible thing that I would do. So web standards. It's 1998, and I don't know. I was on a mailing list with Steve Champion. I was on a mailing list with Glenn Davis. I don't remember who reached out to me. It wasn't my idea. Someone else had the idea. George Olson was on and Glenn Davis were on a mailing list that I didn't participate in. They were on a mailing list where the seed was planted. It was when IE4 came out, and there were four incompatible browsers. And I think Christian Heilemann was part of the original conversation. There's a lot of people that were part of this original, very geeky conversation about, wow, wouldn't it be better if the browsers actually supported W3C standards? Nobody called them standards. W3C specs instead of making stuff up, right? And when I got involved, Glenn Davis involved me to design the site. And then I helped him and George Olson write it and other people write it. Basically, the only reason I took it over was the other people working on it got busy. They had internet businesses that went big. They sold them, or they had other stuff they had to do, family stuff, business stuff, whatever it happened to be. And I just couldn't let go of it. I couldn't, you know what I mean? And it was weird. I was working for other people. I wasn't the boss of anything, but I became for a while the boss of the Web Standards Project. And that was my first, I guess you could call it my first experience of running a distributed company, except it wasn't a company. It wasn't for profit, but it was like running a distributed company. I had to make sure people were doing things, and I had to ask everyone's opinion, and I had to make tough decisions, and people disagreed. There was one really brilliant guy, Steve Champion, who often disagreed with me about stuff. And you know, maybe he was right. The point was we had to find a way to negotiate. What do we do if there's basically two dominant voices that disagree strongly and other people have mixed reactions? So like there was like learning about how to deal with situations like that was kind of it was challenging and very interesting. And I learned a lot from the people, Dory Smith, Tim Bray, the father of XML, was one of our group. Jeff Veen was one of our group. Todd Farner, the guy who invented the Doctype switch, and about a million other things, was one of our group. Todd was maybe the smartest guy in the world, but he never wanted to. He was all total behind the scenes guy, and as you know, he's been making bicycles for. He left the web. He left the web before, I think, before Mozilla even came out. He was like, I'm done.
Oh wow.
To make bicycles in New Hampshire or Oregon, I should know. I met him once. I met him once with Tontek. But anyway, through that world, by 1999, I started to get to be on secret mailing lists with browser makers, and got to soften the tone. Initially, since we didn't think anyone was going to listen, we took Web Standards Project took a very harsh tone toward.
Right. You were very much like everybody needs to get on this bandwagon and you're slowing the whole industry down and screwing it up if you don't. No, but that was true. But you definitely took that line.
We took a very aggressive line, and we had a character called the Wasp. I think Glenn Davis was the first to sign to write and sign opinion pieces, The Wasp, and he wrote these really funny, edgy pieces, and I wrote some with Tim Bray when Glenn left, and there was this edgy, aggressive tone, and that was really the high point of it in a way. Once the browser maker started to see the light, then it became a long slog of working with them, and of course, a lot of people left because it's actually much easier to start a protest movement than it is to keep moving for change. Like there were, you know, Dory Smith stayed on board, Steve Champion. There were a lot of people who stayed and worked really hard, but it was it stopped being let's antagonize these jerks who don't get it, and it started being, you know, we created the it was originally the Seven CSS Samurai with Eric Meyer. That's why I met Eric Meyer, Todd Farner, John Alsop. These really brilliant people, right? Who ran tests on Opera 4 and IE4 to point out their most glaring deficiencies in CSS compliance, so that the browser makers could fix those deficiencies.
Yeah.
We didn't think, you know, we knew you couldn't. The original CSS specifications were monolithic, right? Like CSS 3 is modular, which means there's little pieces of it that browser makers can experiment and test and get right. And, you know, so there's still, you know, there'll be something in Safari and Chrome, and designers will experiment with it and they'll give feedback to the browser makers who will then change it, right? So that's how specifications work now. That's how CSS 3 works. But CSS 1 and CSS 2.0 and 2.1 were these big monolithic specifications. So it would be very hard to get everything right. You wouldn't get everything right. And so our idea was just to give browser makers the feedback they needed to get, like, you know, kind of an 80-20 thing. Let's give them what they need to stop, and, you know, like Netscape 4 inserted browser defaults, you know, into, if you told it, you know, I want a margin of 20 pixels and or something, it would say, yeah, 20 pixels plus this default that I'm randomly going to add because I'm Netscape. So, you know, it was like trying to find things like that and get them to stop, or, you know, all the bugs, just not all the bugs, but just all the big bugs.
It's still amazing, though. You got to think about it, that the work that you were doing there, the work that you guys did at that time period, It's not even that it's taken for granted now that you would just use web standards. It's like that's really all there is now. Everybody who's developing, I don't want to say everybody in a blanket statement, but typically if you find people in a self-respecting agency, they're building stuff, they're doing it this way.
There are still people, some companies and some products that make layouts with tables and do all that kind of stuff and use font tags and everything, but it's you're right, it's web standards were the edge case. Once we got the browser makers to implement standards sufficiently, almost nobody was using them, and so we had this big struggle to persuade other designers, it's really cool, you can do this, and like, here's all these reasons why you'd want to do this, you know, your site will be portable, it will work right on a mobile, it will work on a mobile device, your site will you know, your data will be transportable, your data will be semantic, so you can store actual meaningful, you know, text fields and all this kind of stuff, and now that is the norm, now it's taken for granted, so that's nice. Yeah, that is nice. I think we did something good.
You did something very good. It really did change the industry to the point where, without something like that, you know, do you think that their Internet Explorer 9, for example, would be talking about this? Do you think that?
No.
I mean, it really is. It really is.
Without that, you wouldn't have things like Twitter. The whole Web 2.0 and whatever we're in now, all that came about basically from web standards, JavaScript, right? Web standards, JavaScript. So wouldn't exist. We would instead probably have, you know, it really would be a Silverlight web and a Flash web and like 17 other proprietary technologies. And everybody would have to have different plugins. Now we're taking the plugins out of markup, right? Now in HTML5, you don't even need plugins for video, because why did you, Because, you know, every website in the world has video. Even the crummiest little website has video or audio on it now. And yet we've never had a way of expressing that in markup. We've never been able to just have a video element or an audio element. Think about that. 16 years into web development, and we've, you know, 16 years since HTML2 came out, HTML2 being the first HTML spec, right? 16 years since it came out, and we finally have a, you know, video and audio in the almost ready for primetime HTML5 spec. Right. So that's pretty amazing. I think all these things, you know, there's a lot, obviously the Web Standards Project can't take credit for. A lot of other people joined in, a whole lot of people contributed their thoughts, and all that stuff's still happening. I mean, there's lots of people doing amazing stuff now, like, you know, Paul Irish, for example. You know, everywhere you look, Paul Irish is doing something else awesome for the community. So I think that spirit of doing stuff for the community and educating each other and figuring out, well, how can we, you know, how can we use web fonts and what can we do with Canvas and how can we make that stuff exist? A lot of people are working on all those things. So, and I don't work on that stuff now. Now I'm making a living, but I really did, you know, I was, at the time of the Web Standards Project, I was 5 years sober, and I had gotten sober by doing service, right? And it seemed to me like a natural extension of that. Like a higher power was just saying, okay, Jeffrey, here's the next thing to do. So you help that guy, right? And you're sober today. And here's this other problem. And by some, you know, you're not a special person, but by some special set of circumstances, you have a set of talents that map really well to what needs to get done in terms of organizing people, coming up with a funny slogan for what you guys are doing, you know, making it look, you know, making it orange so people can complain about how it looks. You have these gifts that can get it to the next level. And then, you know, and then you have the Dave Shays of the world making the CSS in Garden and all the other amazing stuff that happened that, you know, turned people on and is still turning people on. And yeah, so there was, I don't know what when the tipping point happened, but now we do expect, and mobile is huge, right? You know, having WebKit in my pants all day long. Seriously, I've got WebKit that's smaller than my hand. I've got a WebKit browser that's smaller than my hand that I can call on all the time to experience rich websites made with HTML, CSS, and JavaScript. That's pretty spectacular.
That seems to be what everybody's talking about these days, is building things for WebKit for iOS. That seems like that's like mobile is today, I feel like the first, because I remember when the web was brand new and I worked for a company that we did not online seminars, not screencasting, but real life, like people would pay $100, $200, $300 to come into a room. They'd get out of work. They'd go into a conference room and I'd be up at the front of the conference room with a projector and slides describing, you know, this is what the internet is, because people didn't know. And these were people who were business people who heard you could make like $1 million on the internet. This is so far before the .com.
They didn't think you could make money on it until the .com, right? The .com was like this sudden greed bubble that started in like 1997,
yeah.
I would say.
Yeah. This was before that. And people still had the sense, though, that you could make money. They didn't know what it meant or how or what it was. These were people who were getting, you know, a PPP connection or a slip connection through a modem. And this was, you know, they knew it was out there. They knew it wasn't AOL. But like they didn't know how to use a web browser.
It looked like a fad, but it quickly became a fad, even though it wasn't going to last and the internet didn't really mean anything to a lot of business people. They had that false assumption. I think they realized that they needed to be on it, kind of like everyone needs to be on Facebook today. Like whether they do or not, everyone feels like I've got to have a Facebook presence. I don't have a Facebook page. I'm on Facebook, but I don't have a page, which, you know what I mean? Or I don't have a social media strategy. Oh my God, what's going to happen? I don't have, you know, it was like that. I need an internet presence. It was before we were selling anything on the web, but companies, they felt they had to at least dump their brochures onto the web, right? And I remember printing out web pages, like printing out every page of a site, crafting every page by hand because there wasn't a CMS.
Right.
And printing it and Xeroxing it and then stapling together, bringing these things that look like waitress pads, like giant waitress pads, to this meeting so everyone could look at these black and white laser printouts of their color website and go, why is this so far down? Or, I don't like this spacing. You go, well, we can't control that. You know, or you go, okay, we'll put an extra break tag there.
Right.
I mean, yeah. The first website I worked on, with two other guys, Steve McCarron. Oh my gosh. I was afraid I would do this. Alec Pollock, thank you. Thank you, Jesus. I had a momentary blackout on a guy's name, a really nice guy who I like a lot, who's brilliant. And I hate when that happens. Alec Pollock, Steve McCarron. Anyway, after the site went up, David Siegel's book came out. It was before his book. After the site went up, I found David Siegel's website at the time, and I don't remember what that was called. Do you remember?
I do not.
Happy Gumdrop or something. It was like, or maybe it was dsiegel.com. Might have been just dsiegel.com. No, it was called something else. Anyway, he talked about using tables and using some like Netscape, some experimental Netscape 1.2 property to like basically turning on cell padding in the table,
mm-hmm.
and then turning off the visibility of the bevels that Netscape would create.
Oh,
in the
right,
table
right.
To create a gutter. And I thought that was so brilliant. And I went by, sweet talked Dara Cohn, who was the Warner Brothers producer, into giving me the password to the FTP access for like an hour. So I could just go recode our pages so that they had white space, so they had gutters. I was really thrilled with that too. And the kids today, the kids today when they're making light boxes or whatever, it's the same thing. It's just a lot less primitive. I mean, I think about those one reel silent movies where a guy steps on a hose and then looks at the hose and then the other guy unsteps it and water unsteps it. That's nice. And the water squirts in his face, and that was a comedy.
Right. You
know, it lasted 60 seconds. But the creativity it took for those people to come up with that comedy was just as great as, what it takes today to make Knocked Up.
Are you still excited about the web the way it seems like you were back then?
Yeah, totally. Aren't you?
I am. I mean, I feel like if anybody might not be, though, it would be you, because it feels like you've seen it all. You've been doing this. I mean, if it's possible to be, and I mean this as a compliment, if it's possible to be a veteran of the web, that's what you are.
Yeah, I'm certainly not the only one. There's a lot of people around my age or younger, but who started younger, who've been doing this for coming up on 20 years now, and it is kind of crazy. But if you'd asked me 4 years ago, I might have been less excited, because I think there was a lot of excitement around money and building social networks then, generally, but there wasn't as much excitement about, I think there's a, you know, I've been talking about this a lot, but I think there's a technological convergence, several technological convergences happening at all at the same time, and they're happening at the same time as a certain level of maturity has come into web education. Not, I don't mean in colleges, and I don't mean what they're teaching in design schools as far as web education goes, because, you know, for the most part, that's a total loss. That's way behind the times and meaningless and beside the point and sad and tragic and a waste. But in terms of where people's heads are, people who are blogging and going to conferences and, you know, paying attention and making stuff, right? People who are making stuff now. There's the huge rise in mobile, and Luke Rablewski has a session on this that's amazing. But, you know, it's growing 8 times faster than the web grew, right? Mm-hmm. And there's 2 smartphones sold for every PC, and he's got lots of statistics, like amazing, wonderful statistics. And basically, we've got all these WebKit browsers out there, right, in these mobile platforms, and that are basically replacing the dumb phones. And this is how people are getting online now. You know, they're not just sitting at their desk for an hour, or they're not just downloading porn at night. They're, at a desk. They're actually, they're checking in when they're, you know, when they have 2 minutes of boredom at the grocery store, or when they're waiting to pick up their kids, or, you know, people are constantly during this, there's this ubiquitous connection happening. It's changing the way people interact with web content and web applications. And it's happening at the same time that we're developing a real expertise in user experience, a real facility for user-centered design. Most people now understand that it's, you don't just put your brochure online and, you know, hope users come, and you don't just have turf wars and, you know, and put everything in a flyout menu and say goodnight and think you're done. But most people understand now that you actually, if you're going to the trouble and expense of creating something on the web, you actually want people to engage with it. You want to have a strategy before you make anything. You want to have a reason to make it, just like you wouldn't randomly publish a bunch of typed pages and call it a novel. You don't randomly publish a bunch of junk and call it a website. Instead, right, you think about, how do I want to engage with an audience? How do I want to get people involved with my brand, or with our university, or with the struggle against cancer, or whatever it is? There's almost no barrier of entry for creating apps because of, you know, Ruby on Rails and PHP and all the cool stuff that's out there, LAMP stacks, all the great, you know, enabling technologies that are out there. And we've got HTML5 and CSS3 happening at the same time. So, and we've got, you know, the WebKit browsers that understand HTML5 and CSS3 are in the phones. So all this is happening at the same time.
Right.
You know, there's a maturity in how we approach our craft. There's an understanding about users. There's a desire to make apps. There's these platforms to make apps. There's the web itself is the greatest web app platform. And there's these little things in our hands that we want to do all kinds of cool stuff with. So all that is making it a very exciting time to be online. It's a very exciting time for web standards because all the stuff's based on web standards. So it's fantastic. So I'm very psyched. And I get, you know, I publish a magazine where every 2 weeks we're publishing something meaningful by someone really smart, a couple people really smart. And I know almost every month now I'm doing a show. And, you know,
is that how frequently you're doing it now? Every month you're doing?
Well, we've got 6 conferences this year. And I'm also doing, I'm speaking at Dibby, in Gateshead, UK. I'm speaking for the National Association of Government Webmasters and Do It with Drupal and Ed Yui. So, for many years when my daughter was younger and, you know, when my ex was pregnant, I wouldn't speak. I was really trying to limit how much I spoke. But now I'm doing it more. And, so I'm constantly out there and I'm just seeing such smart people and hearing what they have to say. You know, you sit in the audience and watch these people who are smarter than you talk about really cool, amazing stuff that's happening on the web right now. And it filters into how you think, and it filters into the next talk that you'll give. And so we're all sort of rubbing off on each other like pennies shining each other as we – I don't know if that metaphor really works.
I love that metaphor.
But so, yeah, so it's really exciting. I'm smarter because I just spent a week with Eric Meyer and Luke Rubluski and Jared Spool and all these people that I've been talking about, Andy Clark. I mean, you know.
I was talking with somebody who was there, and I asked them, I said, how was it? Did you have a good time? And they said, it was amazing. They said it was the time of their life.
Really? That's good. That's really good. Do I know who this person is?
Transformative experience for them.
Transformative. Good. That's what we want it to be. I really want the conference to be an experience where you might go in. When you go into the conference, you may be like, you may be the only web person at your company, and so you're really overburdened doing stuff, or you may be part of a team, but you're a beleaguered team, not getting enough respect, or you might have a great job. I'm not saying that. You may have a really great job, but we still get caught up in the day-to-day and we forget how amazing it is what we're working on. You know, we're creating something that's as radical as the printing press, maybe more so, right? We're transforming the way people share knowledge, the way they interact, commercially, emotionally. It's this huge thing, and we're the people who are making this happen. And I want people to come in, get charged up, get excited, have all kinds of new ideas they want to try out at their job immediately. And that's like the biggest feedback that we get is like people feel charged up and they feel they can't wait to go back to work. I mean, imagine that. It's like,
yeah.
Like when I go on, I don't like vacations. You go on a vacation and you don't want to go back to work. It's like, that's the last thing you do. Like, you're just like, wow, I wish I could just keep sitting in this hotel looking at the ceiling. So, you know, but this is a place where people come to this thing and then they can't wait to get back to their desks and start rethinking their mobile strategy, or they can't, you know, rethinking their content strategy, or, you know, people get really excited. So that's a great thing. And, you know, our speakers, I mean, we also, they're really nice people and they interact with their, someone was saying, they couldn't, an attendee was telling me they couldn't believe how approachable everyone was. And like, we work on it too. And we don't have to work hard on it because the people are nice, normal, approachable people. But we do coach everyone. And it's important that you know, people come a long way to see you. And, you know, they don't want to see all the speakers sitting at lunch.
Yeah.
Schmoozing, talking about, you know, oh, I'm going to be in Japan next. Oh, yes, I'm going to speak in Japan too. Like, nobody wants to see that. You know, they actually, I mean, sometimes I feel like I intimidate people if I sit down with them at lunch, and I certainly don't mean to, but maybe they actually wanted an hour off to not, you know, not have their brains being stretched, and maybe they just wanted to talk about, but anyway, too bad, because I sit down and I just ask them what they're doing and where they work and what they do, and, you know, and usually people are happy to talk about that stuff. It should, and then we have three parties. We have three amazing sponsors for the show who sponsor these ridiculously awesome parties.
What goes on at one of these? Can you talk about it?
Oh yeah, yeah. Nothing. I mean, people have drinks and they have snacks and they network. That's all. So, you know.
You really can't say no. That's cool. I mean, if you can't say
no.
I get it.
Media Temple and Typekit and Extensis are sponsoring these things, and it's amazing.
That's cool. Right,
it just keeps the conversation going. People, you know, they exchange business cards and they exchange ideas and they, I don't know what else they exchange.
Wouldn't it be cool if the next big, really big startup that happens is born at one of these events?
I know.
To say that?
There are products that have come out of the event.
Can you share what any of those are?
Feet Apart, right?
Yeah. Talk about that. There's not a lot of people that know about that. I can't go to the conference, but I want to know what's going on. I want to know what all my friends who did get to go are talking about. How do I do that?
Right. Okay. So, Nick Sargent, Pete Carl, Steve Losh, and Ali, made this amazing app for us. It started with Nick Sargent and Pete Carl. They were at, they were at an event apart 2 years ago, maybe in DC. No, where would it have been? I don't. Maybe it was Boston. I don't remember. Maybe San Francisco. I don't really remember. But they were. They got the idea. To basically aggregate all the tweets about our show in real time and stream them and automatically refresh them. So it. I mean, you could some of the functionality you could get from like, you know, Twitterific or Tweety or something by doing a search on AEA, let's say. But if you searched on AEA, that wouldn't tell you if someone was saying something about an event apart. So they basically set up a whole bunch of hashtags and keywords and filters. So there's, you know, as little, you know, so you don't get false positives. You don't get stuff that's unrelated. And it just creates this community because, as everyone knows, right, the back channel's huge. And no matter how great your speakers are, people are also paying attention to their Twitter stream. People are looking at their laptops or their phones or something. And they're, you know, so why not channel that conversation? Why not let people actually exchange information about the show while watching the show on a back channel that's basically built on top of Twitter. So that's what a feed apart is. And while watching the show, so, you know, Aaron Walter is talking about a particular tool and he shares the URL for that tool and then he moves on and someone says, did anyone get that URL? And someone else says, well, it's right here. And so, and I would say at least half the audience is tuned into it so that the audience has this extra audience channel that's kind of dialoguing with the speaker as the speaker's talking. Not the speaker's not reading it and the speaker's not going, you people think I'm crazy. No, I'm not crazy. It's not like that. It's not a confrontational thing, but it's more like an accompaniment. It's like the audience is playing rhythm guitar to the speaker. So it's pretty cool. I don't know if that analogy works either, but it's a really nice tool the guys built. And we liked it so much, we commissioned them to do more with it, and we license it from them, and we tricked them into a highly restrictive license. No, I'm kidding. But
it's all very good. It's very good. Yeah. It's a neat way to stay in touch and feel connected even when you can't. And I know a lot of people at the conference are doing it, using it too.
Yeah, and the only thing we haven't figured out is what to do between shows.
Mm.
We sort of turned it off between shows.
Yeah, you kind of have to.
Yeah, you kind of have to. We have a Facebook page so people can keep in touch that way between shows.
I'm changing subjects before we wrap this thing up because we've got to. But I have a question for you. There's something that you used to do periodically. You do it once in a while now. It's like a real treat when you do it. But you used to share your desktop, your screenshot of your desktop. You'd put it up on thiseldman.com. And boy, I tell you, I've mentioned this before. Every time we do one of these shows where it's just you and me talking, I mention this.
Why do you like this so much?
I'm one of those people. I love to see how people work. I love to see their icons. I love to see the whole setup. It's not like a voyeuristic thing as much as it's just wanting to somehow. It's like a window into the person's mind in a very creative, inspirational.
Yeah, no, I get it.
Kind of way.
Yeah, I get it.
I used to do that, and I remember that I just you. But the thing was, you did like now. I don't want to call it passé to do that, but I mean, people do this all the time. There's websites devoted to this. People put it up on Flickr all the time. You were doing this before anybody else was doing this. And I would learn things from the way you had stuff set up. I would learn, like, nowadays, you look at Twitter, the minute that a new app comes out, there's 100,000 people Twittering about it saying, oh, I tried this app in my menu bar. It's really cool. Retweet, and you find out about the cool app or the cool utility or the cool thing. I didn't know what drag thing was until I saw it in your screenshot. And it changed the way I worked for years.
Yeah. Do you still use drag thing?
I haven't been using it as much anymore. I kind of went more of a minimalist thing when 10.4 came around. I think that's when I stopped using it. But do you still use it, right? I wouldn't know.
Yeah. So on my laptop, I have a...
what are your computers?
Okay, so I have an 11-inch MacBook Air that I'm looking at right now.
Nice.
That I brought with me to Boston, and there's no drag thing on that. There's really nothing extra on that. It's just Apple's system, the way Apple made it. And you know, sometimes I just have to remind myself to nap. I mean, there's something a little clumsy about not having the shortcuts. You know, there's something kind of nice about opening your mail client by hitting F2, right, which is how I set up drag thing. That's kind of missing when you have to like look down at a bar, right, look down at the dock or do, you know, Apple's key command and then like toggle between things. I don't know. It seems less elegant. Apple's way seems less elegant, less quick anyway. But it's a very simple, clean system, and I never have any problems with the system. On my and then I have... At Happy Cog, I have I guess it's like 2 or 3 years old now. The giant, well, not the biggest. It's a, I haven't measured it, so I don't know if it's 23 inches or 27 inches or what it is, but it's a pretty big Macintosh computer. It's not a tower. It's a, if it's not a tower and it's a desk, then what is it?
If it's not a desktop and it's not a tower?
It's a desktop and it's not a tower. What is it?
An iMac?
Thank you.
Okay.
So it's a nice little iMac. It's the one, you know, it's the one with the little black Arabian Nights eyeliner around the edge. It's not the one where the picture goes all the way to the metal. And I think the new one, the picture will actually transcend the metal. The picture screen will be like 5 inches beyond the actual surface of the computer itself. But this is the first big metal one they did, and it's really beautiful. And so I've got one of those at work and one of those at home. And those do have drag thing on them, on it, and default folder. I miss default folder when I'm not using it, man. Default folder is a tough one to get away from. You mean you don't really need it? There are things you can use what Apple gives you,
yeah.
But it's just, there's just something really nice about clicking in the area where you know you have an open window underneath some other open windows and having that materialize and dropping stuff into it. And of course I have Dropbox on everything, right?
You have to have Dropbox in 2011.
You have to have Dropbox and MobileMe unless you're using Google apps, but I've got MobileMe and it works. Right.
Yeah.
And that's all. And no, Growl and what else? Last.fm, very important.
Mm-hmm.
I'm amazed how much music I'm playing now. It's like I'm constantly listening to. And I turned it off to do the show, but I was like, I'm constantly got music going, and it's fantastic. There's so much energy there. There was a period where I couldn't listen to music; it was too painful. When I quit drinking, I couldn't. There was a period where I really couldn't listen to music. And there were certain movies I didn't want to watch because they would make me want to get high. And I'd been a sober a year.
Had to stop watching stuff.
What did I see? I saw Pulp Fiction, which I loved. But there was this like beauty shot where John Travolta shoots dope. And like there's this close-up of his blood mixing with the heroin and the needle.
Oh, yeah.
And it looks really appealing. Right, it doesn't look. It's not a horror image. It's not. Oh, this is a horrible and sad thing that ruins people's lives. It's like, wow, that looks pretty cool. And then he's like John Travolta sitting in a Cadillac with the roof down, driving down Sunset Strip, wasted, and it just looks really good. And you're like, so it's actually a lying fantasy about what drugs are like. But so I couldn't watch that for a while. But everything's good now.
Everything is good now.
Everything's good now.
And we're done with the show now.
You know, I think you guided me out of the abyss. We started in a very strange place, but
I'm fine with that. I liked starting in a strange place.
Well, it made the listeners go away, but I think the main thing. Anyway, did we actually, were there questions in the chat room? No.
No. I wasn't paying any attention. I was focused just on what you're saying, so I haven't even looked at the chat room.
So would you say that you're Luke and I'm Obi-Wan, or would you say that I'm Dumbledore and you're Harry Potter?
I'm less familiar with the Harry Potter. I think I've seen a movie or two, so I'll have to defer to you on that.
But I would say you're Harry Potter because you're the actual I'm merely John the Baptist, my friend. That's what I'm saying.
Okay. Well, I think that's nice of you. I think it's nice of you to say.
See, you don't really know that story.
Not in the depth that, well, it's kind of a religious thing.
Yeah, right. No.
Isn't it?
So I've heard.
Okay.
There's a really funny, I don't know who she is. She's a Jewish comedian. And she talks about being on the subway and being approached by a religious Christian lady who said to her, "Have you heard the good news?" And she says, "Oh, I'm Jewish. Have you heard the bad news?" She does it much better.
Yeah, I like it though. We should probably end on that now.
We should probably cut that out, but
no, we'll keep that in. But we'll end. Yeah. We'll end now. So
we'll end. Thank you. Have a wonderful day.
Have a wonderful day. We'll see you again next week.
All right.
Have a good one.
Bye.